one of the more well-known accounts from the Old Testament. The excitement in the story we've just read helps it stick in our memories as a shining example of God's power overcoming adversity. As such, it's a staple of any Sunday school program and contains great lessons for our kids, and indeed all of us, as we're encouraged to put our trust in God. There's a great kids' song about it too. Joshua fought the battle of Jericho and the walls came tumbling down. I suspect some of you may know it and perhaps may even have the tune in your head. It's really quite catchy. But if you don't know it, ask one of the children here to sing it for you. I would offer, but I'm afraid if I do, that would ruin it for everyone forever. But Jericho stands out to us because it is a special story of God's people emerging victorious when facing what at first seemed to be a completely impossible situation. Although Israel knew that God had promised to give them the promised land, Jericho stood in their way. Unless they could somehow topple those mighty walls, they would be unable to capture the city, and their path towards the promised land would be uncertain. So the stakes were high for the Israelites, but the walls were even higher. Jericho was a well-defended city, and capturing it would need a strong, well-trained army with excellent military tactics. Or would it? How exactly did those walls come down? Let's look together at the start of our passage, Joshua chapter 5, verse 13, where we see Joshua's posture of faith as he approaches a mysterious being. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" "Neither," he replied, "but as commander of the Lord's army, I have now come." Then Joshua fell down, face to the ground in reverence, and asked him, "What message does the Lord have for his servant?" I'm not really a big TV watcher, and even less so if it's reality TV. But I have seen the occasional episode of a show called Undercover Boss. In this show, various executives of companies pretend that they're new hires and they work on the front lines of whichever company that they run. They get to experience life at the bottom of the ladder. They interact with their co-workers and often hear some honest truths about what it's like to work for their company. At the climax of each episode, the boss will come clean to his colleagues that he is the CEO. Then we get to see everyone's surprise when they find out who they've been dealing with. And sometimes we see their glee as the boss rewards them lavishly for their hard work. Here, Joshua is surprised by an undercover angel or perhaps the Lord himself. He sees some random guy with a sword and goes on up to him and asks, "Who are you?" His reply, "I am the CEO. I am the commander of the Lord's army." Immediately, Joshua fell down and assumed a posture of humility. I think it's worth reminding ourselves of who Joshua was. He was the leader of the Israelites, the Lord's chosen people. And he ascended into this role after Moses died, at a time in history when the Israelites' military campaign was in its early stages. So in one sense, Joshua himself was the the commander of the Lord's army. Then, when he meets some other guy who claims this title for himself, he could have easily started an argument. You're not the leader of the Lord's army. I am. No, I'm the leader. No, I am. It could have sounded like your everyday conversation in a house with small children. Ask me how I know. Yet Joshua doesn't respond like this. The undercover boss illustration might capture some of the surprise that Joshua felt, but it actually doesn't go far enough in explaining who the soldier was, especially in relation to Joshua. Despite the difference in rank and salary, a CEO and a low-level employee work for the same company. Both are employees. They differ in degree, but not in kind. With enough hard work and talent, a low-level employee could, in theory, work their way up the ladder and become CEO themselves one day. But with Joshua and the soldier, this is not so. They aren't just different ranks within the same army. Joshua could never aspire to be the commander of the Lord's army the way this soldier was. He was a different kind of commander entirely, one operating far above Joshua's purposes. So when the soldier says he's the commander of the Lord's army, Joshua responds in faith. Joshua recognizes his status not as a leader, but as a servant. Would you respond the same way? What if you came across someone and they claimed to hold the leadership role that you had? Imagine you met someone new and they said, I am the minister of your church, or I am the leader of your growth group. I am the manager of your company. I am the head of your household. Those would be strange claims, for sure, and indeed a little crazy if the person you met was just a human like you or me. But if you met an angel of the Lord or the Lord himself, would you recognize the truth in those statements? We may have ministries or roles to run here on earth, ministries that God has given us to do, but we are not ultimately in charge of any of them. We would do well to have the same attitude as Joshua. We would do well to remember that even in leadership, we are still servants, and God is the one who is truly in charge. The man appeared to Joshua, and Joshua asked if he was a friend or a foe. I find the answer very interesting too. You would think that someone sent by God to God's people could quite easily answer friend. It's not a hard decision. But he didn't answer this way. Instead, he said neither, or more literally, no. In other words, that is the wrong question. It doesn't matter at all whether the soldier was on Joshua's side, but it only matters whether Joshua was on his. He had no allegiance to Joshua, nor to any human, but to God alone and his will alone. He was not there before Joshua to carry out Joshua's agenda, to help Joshua realize his military goals and desires. No, he was working for and actually leading another kind of army entirely, the Lord's army. Joshua's job was to decide if he will follow and get behind the Lord's plans. If he did things God's way, then they would be on the same side. If Joshua didn't, then there would be trouble, and these two would come into conflict. Joshua fell down and said, "What message does my Lord have for his servant?" We hear the Lord's plan for battle in chapter 6. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men. March around the city once with all the armed men. Do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram's horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing the trumpets. When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have the whole army give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the army will go up, everyone straight in." I would love to have been there when Joshua called his generals around and told them this plan. When I picture them, I see them gathered in a tent around a table with a roughly drawn map of the city and little pawns representing the soldiers. Then Joshua gets up, he clears his throat, and he says to his generals, "Tomorrow battle begins." Then he picks up a pawn, traces a circle on the map. "We are going to march around the city." His generals might think, okay, perhaps to scope out the enemy and see the best place to attack. Then the next day, Joshua says, "We are going to march around the city." The generals now feel a little less sure. "Then we will sleep." And the next day, says Joshua to his expectant generals, "We are going to march around the city." This is a very odd plan, something straight out of Monty Python. "And for the 7th day," adds Joshua, "now for something completely different. We will march around the city, not once, but 7 times, and give a great shout at the end." If you or I came up with this strategy, what are the chances that it would succeed in bringing down the mighty walls of Jericho? Not very high. In fact, most people would guarantee that this plan would fail. Think about it. Marching, blowing horns, and shouting. This sounds like something you'd see at a rugby game and not from the battlefield. But God came up with this strategy, and his plans come with a rock-solid guarantee. This plan, however strange it seems to us, was certain to succeed if it was followed. And this is what the Israelites did. They did things God's way, and the walls came tumbling down just as God said they would. What can we learn from this today? We need to be a little bit careful here. We're not promised land like the Israelites were, and we're definitely not called to pick up weapons and fight people in cities we think might be in opposition to God's plans. Despite this, we can still learn from Joshua's success at this battle. The first point for us is to humble ourselves and follow God's way, not our way. We might not meet an angel of the Lord to tell us about a specific battle plan or problem we have to face. But that doesn't mean that we're left doing whatever we want. We have God's word to lead and guide us. We're called to be in fellowship with one another, to encourage each other, and humbly offer correction if necessary. Together, we can all learn and grow along our walk with God. Did you notice that it wasn't only soldiers doing all the marching? God commanded that there were priests there too. And perhaps even more surprising, he wanted the Ark of the Covenant in the middle of the group. The Ark was not just another piece of religious furniture like a table or lampstand. The Ark represented the very presence of God with his people. Putting the ark in the marching group was like God saying, "I'm going to lead this parade." It's worth spending a moment weighing up our own plans. If there's no room for God at the center of our plans, we should be asking ourselves if we're seeking to follow God's way or just our own. Psalm 127 says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, the builders labor in vain." Following our own plans instead of God's is in vain. It's pointless. A few weeks ago, we read the parable from Luke about the rich man who had a great harvest and wanted to replace his barns with bigger ones so that he could rest and take life easy. But that man didn't even seem to consider God's will in making his plans. And when he died, he left behind all of his wealth, selfishly hoarded, and there it did him no good as he was called to give an account of his life to God. As we make our plans, let us not be like this foolish man. Instead, let's put God's will first, keeping him at the center of all that we do. Why did God have the people march around the city for 6 days and then 7 times on the 7th day? I think this is a lesson for us too about the need to persevere. But this is perseverance in faith, not perseverance of a physical endurance sort. If the walk was short enough that they could do it 7 times in 1 day, then for 6 days they did a single lap, which would have hardly registered any steps on their Fitbits. Yet they were persevering in faith. I wonder if some were tempted to end the wait, to grab their swords and charge, but their faith kept them on track, following God's plan. Even though it may not have been much work, with God doing the bulk of it, the Israelites were still called to persevere with their marching. They had work to do, and they did it. They worked for 6 days, day after day, with no results, and yet they persevered still. And on the 7th day, despite seeing no results for 6 days, they continued to march. Around they went. Once, no results. Twice, no results. 3 times, 4, 5, 6, nothing. 7, nothing. Then a shout. And finally, God acted in a mighty way, and the battle was over. Our physical bodies do get tired, and there's wisdom in taking time out to recharge. Jesus was often found alone, praying, even sleeping. And he certainly didn't spend every waking moment healing the sick and teaching the crowds. But the perseverance found in Joshua is the kind that we shouldn't give up. This perseverance of faith is tested when we aren't seeing any results, despite all the work that we may be doing. On these occasions, it's easy to give up and feel disheartened. But don't despair. God might be testing you, and there may be a great victory just around the corner. We don't know the future, but we do know that we can trust in God to bring the results in his time and for his glory. Robert Morrison, an Anglo-Scottish missionary, was recorded as the first Protestant missionary to go to China way back in the early 1800s. He was asked if he really expected to make an impression on the idolatry of the great Chinese Empire. Morrison replied, "No, sir, I expect God will." Robert Morrison was going to China not to conquer the Great Wall of China, but to win souls for Christ. He knew his work, one man's effort, wouldn't amount to much, but he persevered and he waited on God to bring the result. God could have said to Joshua, "Sit tight, don't do anything. I'll knock over the walls and destroy the city myself." Is there any problem with that? No, God is fully able to work with or without human means. But his normal plan is to use God, is to use people to accomplish his purposes. So even though God caused the walls to fall down, the people still had to march. They still had to shout. And when the walls fell down, they still had to take the city, fighting door to door. In Hebrews chapter 11, we read simply, "By faith, the walls of Jericho fell." How do we know it was by faith? Because the people of God put their faith into practice by marching around the city day after day. They didn't give up after the first day, but persevered in their work as they waited for God to act. We all know that belief is involved in faith. You have to believe something before you can have faith. If you go to a doctor, you must believe that he can help you. If you don't believe it, you'll never go in the first place. Unfortunately, some people stop there with their definition and practice of faith. They think faith is belief plus nothing else. Faith to them is a mental exercise only and without any outward response. In the book of James, we read that faith without works, without a response, is actually dead. This is a worthless faith. Some people go a little further with their faith and are willing to act, but expect 100% certainty before they'll do anything. This type of faith is paralyzed, and it actually isn't faith at all. We meet people like this in the New Testament. In Luke 11, the people are testing Jesus, asking for a sign from heaven. Jesus responds a little later in the chapter, "This is a wicked generation. It asks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah." At this point, we're 11 full chapters into the Gospel of Luke, and Jesus has already proved that he is the Messiah. The Pharisees should know who he is. They should have been waiting for him to come. But when he does come, they ask for a sign. They ask for more certainty, and their lack of faith gets rebuked strongly. Did Joshua ask for a sign? Should he have? He could have said to God, "Please send us a sign, maybe destroy just one section of the wall without any help from our soldiers. Then we'll try your marching strategy." He didn't, though. He acted in faith and was rewarded. Today, we already have enough signs to believe. We have eyewitness accounts of the resurrected Christ captured in a Bible that is reliable in every definition of the word. And we have 2,000 years of church history where people have been living out their faith, even longer. We have each other with countless stories of God's goodness. In truth, though, there is always unbelief mixed in with our belief, but we still need to act in spite of our doubts. And if the message of Jericho is anything to go by, we will be proved right in the end. Ahead of us, too, is a heavenly promised land. I wish that we could see its glory to spur us on in difficult times now. But until then, let us be faithful and act on what we know. So we have some work to do. Yes, God will continue to do all the heavy lifting today, just as he always has. But for us to sit by and do nothing would be an act of disobedience on our part. We are called to be Christ's hands and feet, and this means going places and doing things in his name. As we take up our mission posts here in North Canterbury and each of our neighborhoods, let us persevere with the work that we have been called to do and expect that God will bring the outcome. And let us act on the faith that we have, not on the doubts that we may harbor. And I'd like to close today with a reminder of the battle that we are all in right now. I don't mean the day-to-day struggle of work, relationships, or poor health. Rather, we are in a battle against sin. Sin wants to reign in our bodies and make us obey its evil desires. And like the walls of Jericho, this battle looks unwinnable. And also, like Jericho, it is a must-win battle. Unless we find a way to defeat sin, there is no heavenly promised land for us, no escape from the consequence of sin, no life, only death ahead of us. But we have hope, as God has once again given us a plan that is even more unusual than walking around a city for 7 days. This plan has Christ winning the victory for us on the cross. Jesus died for us. He defeated sin, and we are no longer under its power. Then Jesus rose from the dead, giving us hope that one day we too will be raised up. And finally, like Jericho, this plan asks for our faith. We must put our trust in God, however unlikely we think his plan will be to succeed, because that is the way that God has said victory will be won. So as we face the week ahead, let us remember the lesson of Jericho. Let us trust in the same God that can destroy walls with a shout. Let us persevere in the work that we have been given and wait upon the Lord for the victory that we know he will deliver.